Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Monday, March 7th, 2022. I'm Maggie Lake here with William Browder, the CEO of Hermitage Capital. Bill, thanks so much for being here with us.
Great to be here.
The global economy, you know, continues to reel from the crisis in Ukraine. Oil surged again. We had nickel up an astounding 60% today, right? Wheat is limit up another 7%. U.S. equities closing at their lows as we close trade, which is happening at this moment on the lows of the day. So you know, investors really trying to wrap their head around this. I just want to, before we dive in, for those, many of our viewers know you well, but for those who are not familiar with your background, your firm really made its reputation by uncovering the corruption at Russian firms. You personally became a target as a result. You were banned from the country. The lawyer that worked for you, Sergei Magnitsky, was arrested, died in custody in Russia. You sought justice for him, got the Magnitsky Act passed against a lot of odds, and have really been, you know, toe-to-toe with Putin for, what, the better part of 15 years now. So I can't think of a more perfect person to sit down with at this moment. What do you think the mindset, what do we need to understand about the mindset of Putin at this very critical juncture?
Well, so Putin has been a dictator for 22 years. He's been a dictator who's stolen an enormous amount of money from the Russian people. I guess it's well north of $200 billion. That's money that should have gone to hospitals and schools and filling in potholes and roads and so on and so forth. And so after 22 years, people are kind of tired of him. And he's watched other countries around him have, the dictators in those countries have a problem. He saw Lukashenko, who is the dictator of Belarus, has been there for a few more years than him, almost lose his position because people rose up after a fraudulent election. He saw the Nazarbayev, Nursultan Nazarbayev, who is the dictator of Kazakhstan, getting washed out after gas prices went up dramatically and huge protests across the country. And so Putin is a guy who you know, sees risk and understands risk. And he says to himself, he doesn't want to be sitting duck waiting for it to happen. And so what does a dictator do in a situation like that? He digs into the dictator's playbook and he starts a war. That's what this is about. A lot of people say this war is about, you know, NATO enlargement. They say this war is about Ukraine democracy. And, you know, those are things that probably upset Putin. But the principal driving factor of Putin going to war in Ukraine and why he's doing it now is that he's a washed out dictator who's afraid of getting overthrown, and he needs to find a way of distracting his people and creating a crisis. And that's what this war is all about. And it's important to understand that, because if you understand that, then we can start to think about what are the tools, where's the leverage to either stop him, slow him down, or change his behavior in some way.
Yeah, and that leverage presumably is money. I mean, that's certainly the tool that has been used from the playbook so far. Does it seem like it's working?
Well, it's important to understand who Putin is as a character. And he's not a guy who ever can reverse. There's no reverse gear in Vladimir Putin. All he can do is go forward. And so when we can never expect, no matter what the sanctions are, no matter what the military situation is, for him to say, okay, ceasefire, let's negotiate. That's just not who Vladimir Putin is. He comes from a sort of prison yard mentality where it's always, escalate, show that he's the meanest prisoner in the prison yard. He's ready to take his knife out and shank anyone who comes anywhere near him. That's his psychology. So he's never going to back down or negotiate. And so when we think about what work and what wouldn't work, at this point, now that he's invaded, it's all about making it impossible for him to carry on going forward by depleting his resources. This is a very expensive war, and it requires a lot of money, and we need to impose absolute crippling sanctions. I would describe it as what we need is a total economic blockade, so that he eventually runs out of money and he doesn't have enough money to execute the war. So if you use the car analogy where he can't go in reverse, he can only go forward, we want the car to splutter out because it's run out of gas. And that is, in my mind, the only thing that's going to stop Vladimir Putin from taking over Ukraine and then further challenging us at a NATO neighboring border like Estonia, Lithuania, or Latvia.
And so, you know, certainly the West has moved quickly on sanctions, maybe more quickly than Vladimir Putin thought they would. There seems to be a lot of cohesion, but has it gone far enough? I mean, would it certainly there's carve outs for oil and gas. There's carve outs for companies, Russia, big producer of nickel. Those are carved out. There's been, you know, a lot of conversation about that today as we've watched nickel prices soar 60%. So not only are they not carved out, but there's been a huge increase, you know, in those metals. Is that what needs to happen? Does it need to be absolute? And what are the prospects of that?
Well, the prospects change every day as he commits more atrocities and the world watches them and the world understands that this is like a World War II, Hitler, early World War II Hitler type of situation where we're watching on the television, you know, the humanitarian disaster that he's executed playing out in real time. And so I do think that as this thing gets worse and worse, the sanctions will get tougher and tougher. At the moment, only 70% of the banks are disconnected from SWIFT. And that's kind of a meaningless punishment because the other 30% of the banks can handle the transactions that the 70% of the banks used to handle if necessary. We've sanctioned the roughly a dozen oligarchs. We need to sanction 100 oligarchs, and probably we need to say no more Russian oil. We'll find oil elsewhere. And I think if we do that, then he really is in a terrible, terrible position. And you know, you can see it right now. The Russian stock market is down like 95%. And for what it's worth, if they don't ever get access to capital again, there'll be so many defaults that the equity will be worthless in a lot of companies. You have the ruble down 40%. It's really a quite dramatic situation, more dramatic than anything I've ever seen in my professional lifetime.
Yeah, and we're gonna get to the risks around that as well. But it seems to be that there is some of this is happening through self sanctions. This is a term that's been called that. That although countries themselves haven't banned, certainly this is happening on the energy market, haven't banned oil or gas. Everyone's afraid to touch it because it might be, and then they'll be stuck with it. Is that giving the same effect, or does it need to come from the countries themselves first of all?
No, this is very dramatic. The idea that just about every foreign company doesn't want to do business with Russia totally elevates the level of economic pain that's being inflicted. And so if you have, I've heard these stories about there's no transportation companies that want to take any Russian oil, even if Russian oil hasn't been sanctioned, because they don't want to be in a position where they picked up some Russian oil. They go 10 days to some other place and then they can't unload it. And so better just to avoid it altogether. And I would imagine that that's the same across the board with almost everything. And on top of that, you have all these, you know, there's no more, you can't fly from Russia to anywhere. The entire Aeroflot fleet has been grounded. And it's really just at this point, almost total economic blockade, but there still needs to be more done. And if more is done, I do think that Vladimir Putin is going to be in an extremely precarious position, because this war that he's waging is an extremely expensive operation. It's costing billions of dollars a day, and it carries on. We're on our 12th day, and he doesn't have access to much cash anymore. His central bank reserves in all hard currency is frozen. Now, eventually, he's going to go to the Chinese and say, I need some money. And the Chinese are going to lick their lips and say, okay, we'll give you some money. And it'll be like borrowing money on a credit card, where he can, you know, he has to like pledge all sorts of assets that he never intended to pledge, and so on and so forth. But I do think he's going to run out of money. And at that point, it becomes a very interesting situation. How does he handle it from there?
Yeah. So, you know, if he's attempting to stay in power, if he's motivated by what you think he is, does the pain inflicted on the Russian people work in the favor of seeing him overthrown, or does it dig in and they feel victimized by the West, and it solidifies power around him?
Well, I mean, he's hoping for the latter. We're hoping for the former. There's a total misconception inside of Russia of what's going on. The most Russian people think that there's no invasion, there's no war, there's some kind of limited special operation going on to free Ukraine from Nazi occupation, and it's like a humanitarian intervention from the Russian people's perspective, because that's the propaganda that they're fed. And so in some cases, they may start to be mad at the West, and that's certainly that's certainly his calculation. But I think that, and I saw some clips of Russian people demonstrating not for or against the war, but against higher prices. And I was just listening to Garry Kasparov, the grandmaster chess champion, talking about this, and he says sometimes the fridge outweighs the television.
Yeah, that's a great line, and so true. But we're feeling it too. So at some point, it's a game of attrition, and who can tolerate the discomfort and the higher prices for longer. Although, you know, given the sanctions we've seen, it's going to be a lot more painful for people in Russia. Is there an apparatus? So the ordinary Russian person may not know what's going on, but the oligarchs certainly do. They certainly know what's happening, even if they are in Russia and are somewhat limited by the information they're able to access. Is there an apparatus? Where do you think their head is? Is there an apparatus to begin to think about replacing Putin? How loyal are they still to him?
Well, so the oligarchs are there at his pleasure. In other words, at any moment, he can take away their wealth, put them in jail, or kill them. So they're all terrified of him. And they know exactly what's going on. Their wealth has been decimated, wiped out by 90% or more. And so, whatever they own in Russia is down 95%. And whatever they own in the West either has been frozen or will be frozen. So it's a disaster for them. I mean, it's an unmitigated existential disaster for them. And these are people who don't value anything but money. I mean, it's just the worst thing that could have ever happened. But at the same time, they also understand that if they speak any kind of disloyal statement about Putin, even privately to another oligarch, and it gets back to Putin, he might just take them out right then and there, because he's afraid. You know, if we're talking about this, I guarantee you that Putin is thinking about it. And if he's thinking about disloyalty and betrayal, he's going to go out and look for it and try to figure out who might be in that camp. We've seen this, the way in which people are afraid of him. There was this meeting he had with his National Security Council, where he was like the head of his head of the foreign intelligence or military intelligence, who's the guy who pokes people's eyeballs out with his bare hands, was quaking like a small school child in front of Putin. I mean, this is how scared he has his people. And so I wouldn't be imagining that there's going to be any oligarch uprising. And I also don't think in the short term, anyways, that the people will rise up, not because they're not unhappy, that they're not going to rise up because they're so scared. Anytime any person goes out and demonstrates, they get arrested. And there's these rumors that the peace protesters are going to be the first people to be drafted when they declare martial law and sent to the front line. And so, I mean, he's a brutal, vicious, sadistic man, and it takes incredible bravery to stand up against him. And yes, if everybody stood up against him together, they could he'd be gone in a day. But if you show up and nobody else shows up, then you're gone in a day.
Yeah, That is when you live in fear like that. It's very hard.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
It's very easy to say rise up. It's quite another thing to see it happen in real time.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
You know, when we're talking about the possibility of a complete economic blockade, and especially looking at the metals market today because of what's going on, Wall Street Journal had raised a very interesting question in one of their articles. Are these companies simply too big, too important to the global economy to fail or to strangle to death by that kind of sanctions?
Well, I think the answer is in some cases, these companies are too important in the global economic community to cut off completely. I mean, if you have major commodity producers and you change the supply situation for these commodities, then of course they're going to have a massive dislocation. And we saw this before. Back in 2018, Oleg Deripaska, who's one of the biggest oligarchs, was sanctioned by the U.S. for his involvement or being for his proximity and involvement with Putin and Putin's involvement in hacking the elections of 2016. And this set the aluminum markets in a total frenzy. And eventually they had to unsanction his company because it was just too important in the big picture. And, I imagine that there will be a lot of discussions about that around the world in the next weeks and months. But at the same time, we're also facing an unbelievably dangerous situation. I mean, there's, they're bombing nuclear power plants. He's threatening nuclear war. He's threatening war to anybody who gets involved in helping the Ukrainians in their military defense. This is a very dangerous situation. I mean, I can't overstate how dangerous it is. And I don't think that we should even be talking about money when we're talking about the survival of the planet. I mean, if Putin goes the way that he could go, and by the way, he always does things worse than people expect. That's been my whole experience with him over 15 years of fighting with him. And so we need to really be careful and prepared to try to do whatever we have to do. The only thing we should be maximizing on is, or maybe I think minimizing on, is minimize his ability to carry on with his military adventure, because the consequences are just so horrific. If this thing goes in the wrong direction, that it could truly be, and lights out for the world.
Yeah. I mean, it's well put. It's hard to imagine that we're having this conversation, but I think that people try to sort of put a rational view on it and leave room for an off ramp or negotiations. And from what you know of him, that's just not going to happen. There is no de-escalation in his worldview.
It's not possible. He's never, ever done it in my entire experience with him. And he tends to do these things that appear irrational, where he will cost himself enormous amounts of money, respect, connections, whatever. And this is long before he invaded Ukraine, in other situations, just to show that that you can't get the better of him. That's how he thinks. And so the only tool we really have is just to make it impossible for him to continue this war because he doesn't have the resources to.
Right, no matter what the short-term cost to the rest of us. I want to play, Rob Powell sent a, thinking about these, as we all try to wrap our head around this, sent a macro flash update today. And I'd like to play a clip about the risks that he's thinking about in this ripple effect. Let's have a listen.
If Russia remains out of the global system, which looks increasingly likely, then we probably have a big liquidity problem. And that spits around the world in various ways, whether it's countries who are trying to get access to dollars, banks trying to get access to dollars, or whether it's credit spreads widening as people pull back, trying to assess the risks that are going on. And we don't really know. I mean, how does this affect Egypt? How does this affect the Middle East at large? How does it affect all sorts of countries? Again, we don't really know yet. But that's a hugely concerning moment, and that's a big global recession if that takes place, and a massive monumental geopolitical shift.
And Raoul's full update is available across all tiers on the website. Bill, is have you thought about this? Is there a contagion risk from deplatforming Russia from the global system?
Well, there's a contagion risk from everything that's going on right now. So let's just look at, so one of the things that worries me the most, in addition to the higher energy prices, is the higher food prices. Ukraine is the breadbasket of the world. Russia is a big grain producer. And so you have, this will affect us to make it life inconvenient, more expensive. But there's a lot of developing countries around the world, poor countries around the world, where the people are on the verge of poverty. And this will stick them into starvation territory. And so I think one of the risks that nobody is even thinking about right now is all sorts of, revolutions and uprisings change of governments and hugely horrible things going on in Africa and Latin America and Asia, where we're not even paying any attention. And another contagion thing, which I think is really right in our face, the elephant in the room, is that Putin loves to weaponize refugees. He did that with the Syrian war, where he basically created 5 million Syrian refugees, and they spread out across Europe, and that led to all sorts of change in politics and populist sentiment and crazy people becoming leaders of their countries. And we're now having a second refugee crisis, and this could be much, much bigger than the Syrian refugee crisis, where we're going to be talking about, the prediction for the UN is like 4 million refugees. In a country of 44 million people, I could imagine 10 million refugees. And that's a lot of people to be housed, clothed, educated, and given healthcare all over Europe and all over the world. And that could, that will change the politics. And then of course you have all these, knock-on effects like with liquidity and markets and so on. You'll have a lot of, I'm almost sure that because the Russian government can't get access to capital and there's sort of blockade for all these Russian companies, that a bunch of them, which are sort of have a positive net worth, will have insolvency because they can't get access to capital, and you'll end up with bankruptcies. I imagine that Putin will renationalize a lot of companies in order to get whatever economic benefit is left there. What does that do? And so it's all happened so fast and so dramatically that we're going to see all sorts of ricochets all different ways about this. But again, we should not lose sight of the fact that this is a war with a man who's got nuclear weapons, who started threatening to use them a few days ago. And with that, I think everything else pales in comparison.
Who do you think is the group that needs to be convinced to do a complete economic blockade? Who is reluctant and maybe not calculating the risk properly?
Well, I think there are certain people that just won't be able to participate. So if you're Italy and 100% of your gas comes from Russia, you're not going to be able to get involved, and you're not going to be able to get involved in that part. You're going to have to say, sorry, we're going to have to get our gas. Same thing with Austria, 100%. But with oil. Oil is fungible. It's not like it has to come through a pipeline. I mean, sometimes it does, but oil you can buy from lots of different people and places. And I think oil is easier to blockade.
The potential, Iran talks going on and now opening diplomatic doors to Venezuela. Does that seem like a good idea to replace the Russian oil in that direction, as opposed to, say, ramp up production in the U.S.?
Well, I think that we should ramp up production in the U.S. for sure. And the trouble with all these things is there's always these competing interests. So, in Germany, after Fukushima, they said, we don't want nuclear anymore. Yeah. And so then they started taking more Russian gas. And I mean, so, you know, we don't like Venezuela, but we don't like Russia even more. And so it's a complicated situation. And I don't think there's a right answer to it. But as far as Russia is concerned, Putin's committed such a grave crime of basically tearing up the rule book after the Second World War. And his goal, in my opinion, is to go and stick his tanks on the border of Estonia and say, we're going to go in there and point his missiles towards London and Washington and say, if, you know, are you ready to go to nuclear war with me over this? And he's hoping that we're going to say, you know, the American people are going to say, wait a second, why are we going to nuclear war over a country that none of us can identify on a map? And he thinks he's right about that. And he might even be right about that. You know, he watched America pull out of Afghanistan and let the country, 38 million people, fall into the Taliban for the sake of 3,000 troops who weren't even in a combat situation. And so, you know, that's who we're dealing with right now. And that's his intention. And that is what he's thinking about. And so we don't ever want to get to that place where he's lining up his tanks along the border and threatening us with that.
We have some questions I want to try to get through. PK from The Exchange, and a lot of them are related to the domino, what happens next. Could you please comment on the possibility that Kazakhstan is the next domino to fall? Riots last month, Kazakhstan refusing to join Russia in the Ukraine adventure, and what that means for uranium markets.
Well, Kazakhstan already fell and got picked up. There was a coup in Kazakhstan where the sort of puppet leader of Kazakhstan, this guy Tokayev, who was supposed to just be the puppet taking instructions from Nazarbayev, either engineered or took advantage of this uprising to then call the Russians in. He brought Russian troops in to supposedly quell the unrest, and he became the new dictator. And I don't think Kazakhstan will rise up, but you know, it's uncertain who might rise up, because the moment you have these commodity prices for basic need commodities rising the way they have, anything can happen anywhere. I mean, that's effectively why the Arab Spring took place, was because of with commodity prices going up. And now that we're in this situation, could be Kazakhstan, could be anywhere at this point in time.
Yeah, which is absolutely incredible. Sean is asking, what is your manufacturing and trade policy if you are detaching from China? I'm not sure exactly what he's referring to. Maybe he's been following you, but how does China fit into this? And will they make a deal with Putin? I mean, there was an idea that they were, you know, there was some sort of, you know, at the Olympics deal struck. And then other people have been wondering about that. Does China really want oil this high, this much destabilization? It doesn't really fit into the mode that they prefer when they're dealing with these kind of geopolitics, a little too messy. What do you think about China's role in this?
Well, China is definitely in cahoots with Putin. Xi told Putin, don't invade and don't mess up my Olympic spectacle. And so Putin said, yes, boss, because, you know, China really is the boss in this situation. And so, but they're not like partners, you know, ideological partners, and you know, in any way, shape, or form, they're sort of authoritarian partners. They both want to run their authoritarian regimes. They don't like democracies that respect rule of law and human rights and all that kind of stuff. And so they share a disdain for our way of life. But you know, they're also adversaries in a certain way. Russia's got a lot of natural resources and hardly any people, compared to China with a lot of people and not that many natural resources. And so I can't imagine that it's pleasant for the Chinese leadership to see the commodity prices rising like this, because they're a commodity importer, and that's going to cost them. But at the same time, I can imagine that they're going to kind of look at this situation where Russia has no other choice if they need money but to go to China, and China loves to lend money to people on usurious terms, and so they're all licking their lips right now, thinking, what are some good things that we want to snatch from Russia when they come to us hat in hand, desperate for money?
Ralph is asking, what kind of negative economic impacts do you expect Putin's war will have on neighboring Eastern European countries other than Ukraine?
Well, the most important negative impact is that if we don't stand up to Putin properly and make this almost impossible to go further, we may not have those countries in our world anymore. They may go back into the Russian world. That's what he wants. He wants to sort of redraw the map in a way that, you know, post-World War II, where he controls that whole side of the world. And, you know, that is a, and by the way, everybody in that part of the world is in a state of panic right now. If you're from Poland or Lithuania or Estonia, you know, you're sitting there watching this thing and saying, this could be me next. And it's absolutely terrifying.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
We have a question from Phil asking about certain companies or countries with heavy Russian debt in rubles that will benefit debt reduction due to the drop in the ruble. I'm not sure that's the right conclusion to come from. I mean, if you are sitting with any kind of exposure to Russia, what, you know, is it investable at all? Is that a, you know, an asset or any, is there any upside at all in any exposure to Russia?
Well, I mean, so some people would argue that the price is down 98% in equities and, you know, 80 to 90% in bonds. And so anything that goes down that much should go up. But I would look at the situation first from a moral standpoint. This is like investing in German equities during the Holocaust. I mean, I don't think anyone, any American should be doing this. I mean, it's just wrong. But if the morality doesn't appeal to you, there's a good self-interested reason not to do it, which is that we have effectively expropriated huge economics from Putin, and he's a guy who doesn't respect rules and doesn't respect law. I can't imagine that he's going to allow debt to be repaid by Russia to foreign creditors. Why would he? It doesn't make any sense. And nor can I imagine that he's going to allow foreign equity holders to continue to hold their equity. Why not expropriate, dilute, renationalize, whatever? And so in these types of hostile situations, things could be cheap for a good reason, and they could probably get a lot cheaper. And so even if the morality doesn't appeal to people, self-interest should. And there's a pretty strong argument that when all is said and done, Putin is just going to say, you know, enough of this game of free market capitalism, we'll just take it all for ourselves.
Can Russia survive going it alone? I guess a better question is, how long can they survive going along, even if they're getting, money at a cost from China, if they're completely cut off from the global financial system, or even cut off to the extent they are right now? What kind of time frame does Putin have to make this work for him? How can this work for him?
Well, I mean, there's one argument. It could work for a really long time. Look at North Korea. They've gone it alone and somehow have made it all happen. On the other hand, you can't really do that and run this major international war and expect that to be able to afford that major international war. You got to pull in your horns and, like, you know, really do things tightly and cheaply. And so I don't know if there's an answer to that question. You know, he does have one other thing going for him in addition to these central bank reserves, most of which were frozen, and that is that there's not that much debt in Russia. The debt to GDP ratio is extremely low. And so to the extent that there is somebody who's not sort of, you know, cutting him off, they might be able to argue to themselves that he's got a good credit rating. Although I'm not sure how they're going to argue that to themselves when he defaults on a bunch of other people previous week or whatever that you know scenario turns out to be.
Clearly there seemed to be some miscalculations, based on what we've seen in Ukraine. And yes, it's early days. This is presumably going to get horrible. But I'm just trying to imagine, you made the reference to North Korea, and I think a lot of people are thinking about that. But Putin doesn't seem like somebody who's, you know, willing to be a hermit king. That doesn't seem grand enough for him or a position that he really wants to find himself in with a populace that is suffering. I mean, he enjoyed being on the world stage and the center of it. Does that seem like that will be enough for him?
Well, I don't think he has any choice right now. I mean, it's not like he can just say, okay, enough is enough. I'm going back to where I was. Forgive me. And we're going to say all is forgiven. I mean, he's killed, you know, thousands of innocent civilians. I mean, he's executed a terrorist operation, which was like 100 times worse than Osama bin Laden against the Ukrainian people. I mean, there's no forgiving of this whole thing. And so he's made his bed now. He used to have one foot in the civilized world, one foot in the criminal world. He's put both feet full on into the criminal world. And now he's got to pay a price. And so I don't think that he has that much of a choice. He may not do the North Korea version, but he's going to do his version, which is cutting off all Western information. They might even shut down the internet and create a Russian internet so that nobody has, so it just becomes completely sealed off. And that may be the way he goes about it. I mean, that's what it looks like right now.
Yeah. Which is, I think this is what worries people, that if he's backed into a corner and there are no good options for him, that this is where the real risk comes in. Is there anyone who can speak to him right now? Is there anyone who has influence over him or is thinking?
No, there's nobody who has influence over him. And he's not backed into a corner. He backed himself into a corner. We didn't do any of this. He did it. This is his doing.
Which makes it worse, maybe, in some ways.
But he did this. It's not us. And anyone who thinks that we had anything to do with it, we had nothing to do with it. He did this. And it's his problem. And there's people talking. I hate the word off-ramp. It's not our job to give him an off-ramp. It's our job to just completely emasculate him so that he can't do this anymore. And we should just figure out ways of doing that short of putting boots on the ground, at least for the moment, because we may have to do that in the future. But if we can use our financial power and our unity with other allies to just completely make it impossible for him to do anything because he has no money, that seems to be the best and probably only option we have at the moment.
Bill, given what you know about Russia and the country, is there, if they were able to somehow neutralize Putin, you know, get him to step down, somehow, you know, overthrow him, whatever verb you want to use, is there an apparatus in place for someone to take over? Is there an obvious successor or somebody who could garner support around him to sort of step into a leadership void? Because that's also necessary. You have to have the will to change the situation, but you also have to have a replacement of sorts.
Well, it depends how it happens. If it's a palace coup, they'll stick some other KGB guy in there and we'll probably have more of the same. But there's an absolutely great leader waiting in the wings, who's immensely popular, who has good intentions. His name is Alexei Navalny. Mm. Alexei Navalny was the Russian opposition leader who was poisoned by Putin with Novichok in Siberia and miraculously survived. He went to Germany in a coma for a month, woke up, and when he was well enough, he decided, even under threat of arrest, to go back to Russia, where he's been arrested. And he's the Nelson Mandela of Russia. And should there be a popular uprising, he's the obvious person to lead Russia out of this ugly mess.
If you look at the scenarios, and they're, as we started out saying, they go from bad to horrific. What is the probability? What has the greatest probability right now in your mind?
Well, in my mind, the greatest probability is that Putin destroys Ukraine, and then we have a war with Russia on our hands. I think that's the most likely scenario, unless we get tougher with Putin than we already have been. We've gotten tough, but we need to actually get tougher. And I've read various little snippets here and there about people in the Biden administration being worried about provoking him, and maybe we're being too tough. We have to be tougher. There's another scenario, which is if we are tougher, he could get caught in this quagmire of Ukraine where he doesn't succeed, where he sort of, you know, it's a frozen conflict where he doesn't win, they don't win, and he's sitting there doing what he's doing. And in a certain way, as terrible as that is for Ukraine, it might be the best for the Western world, because it doesn't give him a chance to come to our borders. But that's also likely. The least likely scenario is him saying, "Okay, enough is enough. I give up. Thank you very much," and pulls his tanks back to Russia.
Mm. Todd from the RV site is asking, do you see diplomatic pressure being put on China to help influence a de-escalation?
I've heard that there is, but I think it's hugely unlikely that China is going to get involved in this. I mean, because China is waiting for their, Russia to come with the begging bowl to so they can grab whatever they want of economic benefits from Russia. I think China also enjoys watching us squirm in this whole situation.
It would certainly seem that way. Bill, is there an aspect we're not paying enough attention to, or either a risk that we're not really, I think it sounds like you think nuclear, a risk we're not really putting enough stock in, or on the flip side, a positive outcome or the potential for some reason to be hopeful that, you know, we may not be, again, paying enough attention to? Because it's very easy to hook on. I think it feeds our fear. It's very easy to lock into these sort of worst case scenarios. But I'm just wondering, when you look at that, if there's something that, or an aspect on this risk board that we need to be paying more attention to. And by that, I mean the game, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, there's one thing, the upside scenario.
Yeah.
Which I haven't talked about.
That's what I'm asking about. Yeah.
The upside scenario is that, Russia, Vladimir Putin, was completely overplaying his hand, that his military actually can't do this, that they can't succeed, and that the Ukrainians, because they're fighting for their home and their freedom and their children, are just so much tougher than the Russians, and they know their territory. And I've read little inklings of this. So, for example, this 40-mile convoy outside Kiev is stuck because the Ukrainians have blown up the bridges across various rivers, so they can't get anywhere. The Ukrainian soldiers have brutalized and killed the front of the convoy and the end of the convoy, and all the trucks are all burned out on the road, and so they can't get past it. And that the Russians are cut off, their supply lines are cut off, and so on and so forth. And so I can imagine, and this is, I don't think it's a likely scenario when you look at the overwhelming machinery and weapons that the Russians have, but you know, there's a scenario where the Ukrainians actually hold off the Russians and defeat them. That you know, at the end of the day, the Russians, you know, burn through all their equipment and all their soldiers, or many of their soldiers, and all of a sudden, Putin is completely, you know, destroyed, and his whole thing of being such a tough guy, his image is completely destroyed, and at that point, you know, somebody comes in and says, "Well, you've led us down this tragic and horrific road, and we want to get rid of you, and we're going to." That's the upside scenario. I think it's low probability, but I read and probably look for hints of that in between the lines of all the terrible things I read to find that. But I don't think that that's what's going to happen. But you know, we can all hope and pray that that happens.
Yeah, I've been looking for those same lines and glimmers of hope, given all that we're talking about, and it's difficult. I think we can end on this, though, and the one thing that we don't talk about a lot, we're talking about the weaponization of the financial system, the economic war that we're basically in already to try to prevent a conventional war. What about the information war? We know they've cut off the internet. We know other, you know, all sorts of tech companies have pulled out of servicing the Russian people. But, you know, we've seen the sort of power as they're driving in of invading a country that speaks their language, and the people directly are appealing to the soldiers in a very civilian tone. What about that? You know, what about efforts to sort of kind of wage an information war? Can information get into Russia? Are there back channels? Are there ways to try to push on that front?
Well, he's making it as hard as possible for us to do that because he's gotten rid of every single independent media source. He's cut out all the, you know, BBC and CNN and Radio Free Europe and all the places where people would get honest, objective information. Cut out, you know, TikTok is no longer there. And
yeah, I was thinking even in the age of social media, we're seeing even TikTok is shuttered.
You know, it's all getting shut down. And then he's busy blasting his narrative across all of the remaining information portals so that the Russian people have a completely distorted view of what's going on. And will that be, is that permanent? Eventually, you know, people whose children were sent to war aren't going to come back, or they're going to come back in coffins. Although they brought moving crematoriums to just destroy the bodies so that no one's ever going to know what happened to a lot of these soldiers. But still, you know, people aren't going to come back from the war, and stories will come back and information will spread. And hopefully that will get through to people. But right now, the Russians all think that this is a peacekeeping operation that's being run in Ukraine. And I've heard stories of, you know, split families, half in Ukraine, half in Russia, where the people in Ukraine are telling their Russian, like a daughter is telling her mother, we're being bombed. And the mother said, that's impossible. I'm watching the news and that's not going on.
Yeah. One has to wonder in this information technology age we live in, when everyone has a smartphone in their hand and a computer in their hand, though, how long you can keep that veil of misinformation down. And maybe that's the other area that we can look to with hope.
Look at the United States. We have full access to information and half the country believes one thing and half the country believes another thing. So why is there to be any different in Russia?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Bill, I keep hoping that one day we're going to end one of these conversations on an up note, but unfortunately it's a situation we find ourselves in. But we appreciate you coming on and sharing your insight and your, you know, in-depth knowledge of the workings of Vladimir Putin and his mind. I hope the next time that you come on, it can be under better circumstances, but we sure appreciate it.
Well, maybe we can celebrate a Ukrainian victory next time. But
yeah, here's hoping, and we're going to need a lot of that. Thank you so much. Thanks for all the great questions and for all of you for watching. Tony Greer is going to be here hosting War and Pies. You know, it's going to be fantastic watching the commodity market, and he'll have a lot more information on these huge moves we're seeing. I know we had a question about aluminum. Well, I'm sure Tony will cover that tomorrow, so be sure to tune in. And Raul is going to be here on Friday. He'll put a lot more flesh on the bone about what he's thinking, and I'm sure he's going to talk about what it means for cryptocurrencies as well, their role in all of this. He'll be here on Friday, March 11th, so be sure to tune in to that as well. In the meantime, take care and good luck out there.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.